Revenue is open.
Did you notice that about me?
Good afternoon, everyone. We're going to look at the issues of connection and disconnection, enrolling reconnects. So I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 213 and Senate Bill 214 today. And we're down two members. Senator Riley and Senator Boquist will not be here. So let's start this off with Kyle and Chris to make a presentation on some of the issues that we'll have to wrangle with if we make any change.
So while Kyle's getting set up, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The two bills before you obviously deal with the reconnect. Senate Bill 213 is our more traditional reconnect bill, and it just updates the date from 2018 to 2019. But what it also does is it ends the rolling reconnect. So everything we would be if that were to become law, everything we would be tied to would be the IRC in effect on December 31st, 2018. So that deals with the issue of a rolling reconnect versus what we're calling a static reconnect. And the static reconnect is everything is tied to a fixed date, and the state, the legislature then would opt in to federal changes every year. So the choice there is static connect or rolling reconnect. Senate Bill 214 deals with the point at which we connect. So under current law, our starting point is federal taxable income. The intent of Senate Bill 214 is to move that starting point from federal taxable income to federal AGI. We're working on an amendment to the bill that would be a little cleaner in that process, but conceptually that's what it's doing. So so just for context, you have two decision points. Static connect or rolling reconnect is one decision, and another decision is the connection point, federal taxable income or federal AGI. Those are independent policy choices.
I was going to have to point a clarification, but I'll wait for you to be done.
No.
Thank you, Senator Hess. So I just want to understand something. So making this decision during this session, can you just walk me through real quickly about which tax year, what starts, and can it ever be revisited, like in 5 or 10 years, go back and undo it? I just want to understand the consequence of the decision.
So right now, current law right now, we are tied to federal IRC in effect on December 31st, 2017. Basically, conceptually, if you had all of the Internal Revenue Code here that was in effect on December 31st, 2017, those are the laws that we tie to. The exception to that, or in addition to that, we have a rolling reconnect, which is a continual tie to the definition of federal taxable income. The context for that is within the Oregon Constitution is that the legislature can't cede its authority to anybody, including the federal government. So when establishing an income tax, we tie to federal law, but it has to be a date in the past so that the legislature could conceptually look at every Internal Revenue Code and see what we're tying to. So it always has to be a date in the past. By convention, we've chosen December 31st of the prior year. There have been some exceptions, but that's the convention. The exception to that in the Constitution is that we can have a rolling reconnect, a continuous tie to the definition of federal taxable income. The implication of that is anytime the Congress changes the laws and it changes the amount of federal taxable income, we would automatically be tied to that change. And whether it be a revenue gain or revenue loss, it would automatically affect Oregon's revenues. And that's the rolling reconnect.
That's higher. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. And so that's the one decision point. The date, right? And so right now, we are tied to December 31st, 2017. The bill 2013, Senate Bill 2013, would move that date to December 31st, 2019. Effectively tying to any changes that occurred in 2018. And there weren't a whole lot of change. Speaking a little bit loosely here, there weren't a lot of changes in 2018. You did hear from the Oregon Society of CPAs on those changes. The big tax change that occurred was at the federal level in December of 2017.
Right.
And that was the one when we went through this in 2018. We tied to most of the provisions and there was significant debate about opting out of one of those decisions. So if 213 were to become law, you could revisit this at any time. This wouldn't be permanent.
Okay, that's okay. That was my one question.
Right.
So it's just a follow-up. Thank you, Chair Hess. So I thought that the answer was that you could always change it in the future, but I just wanted to get that on the record. But then second of all, I don't understand why one would not want to be disconnected, because you would always want to assess what the situation is and always have the option to connect or not connect. It would seem that that would be what's in the best interest of the state based on what you've said, but obviously we'll learn more. But
That is the opt-in approach. Maybe see what happened and then deciding, yes, we want to do these things. The CPAs have signed up, so you'll hear from them directly. Part of the general discussion is ease of taxpayer and the notion of conforming with federal law being a default position.
And one last question. I'm sorry, Chair Hess. Thank you. And then other states, generally, how does this work?
I actually don't know if they have a rolling reconnect. We'll have to look that up.
41 states have had their calculation at adjusted gross income. It's a different beast, but that's why, for example, on that, would you say significant pain? It was significant pain.
Significant
disconnecting
pain.
Last year. They didn't have to go through that. And that was just, they could have opted in, they could have passed it and connected, but they just didn't have to deal with it. And so it was a non-issue. But we have, I don't want to say it, this unique arrangement. But that was what sort of prompted us during the interim to look at, do we really have to pass a state law if we find that one of the federal policy decisions isn't right for Oregon in order to disconnect? Or should we do it just in reverse and say, yeah, this all looks fine to us, so we'll connect to these. So it's really a very simplistic way. A decision is whether we can opt in or opt out on our own without this significant pain of opting in. We just had that a few weeks ago with a long discussion about the gambling issue. And it's just really an interesting policy decision. The adjusted gross income level of calculation is different, but it also gives us that same situation. So there's just two ways to deal with whether to automatically stay connected. And I understand the accountants need to keep things simple, but every once in a while you have these policies that are out of sync with where Oregonians are.
Thank you, Chair Hess. Some of the reasons for my question, I was trying to, going back to the policy in question, the policy aspect of it is, one, is there any kind of impact by having it there not be, you know, consistency year to year? And is that needed for people when they're filing taxes or having the potential for that to change? I don't know if that's something that needs to be considered or if that's not very relevant or not. That was something I just didn't completely understand. I mean, if it were to be that we waited to see if we were going to connect or not, would that be for long-term planning, any kind of decision-making for individuals? Mm-hmm.
Well,
I don't know. Maybe that is not an issue. Feel free to say so if it's not.
Well, any of the decisions would be none. Any of the decisions could be revisited every year. I mean, these whatever changes the legislature makes this time aren't permanent moving forward.
Okay.
What the uncertainty that would, I think, pop up for taxpayers is if the federal government passes a tax law, the question is, will Oregon tie to those changes or not? And in many respects, it just changes the nature of that question, because the legislature can disconnect as well.
Okay.
So it's that opt-in or opt-out kind of debate.
Okay. Thank you for indulging my questions, Chair Hess.
Chris, just one quick point. I think we've talked about this before, but were we to go to the adjusted gross income level of calculation, we would, the understanding I think with everybody is that we would buy back the deductions that are there. Nobody is contemplating just doing that. Otherwise, it would be like a giant $800 million revenue gain or something without those.
That's correct, Chair Haas. If the only change was move from taxable income to AGI, that's a huge revenue gain. And the PowerPoint that Kyle's going to go through is talking about all those policy choices in there. And what we're talking about there are Schedule A deductions. So we're talking home mortgage interest, charitable contributions, property taxes. And you can certainly move, you can move to AGI in a revenue neutral way where you adopt all those policies. Maybe that's the easiest way to say that.
Yes. Okay. Well then, Kyle.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yeah, as Chris was alluding to, what I have for you today, this is up in OLS. It's under Senate Bill 214 is the presentation I have for you, because that is the one relating to the itemized and the standard deduction. But what I plan to do is go through Oregon itemized deductions, or the itemized deductions that are on the Schedule A form, discuss those in a bit of detail. And then I also have near the end some information relating to how other states are, what their policy is in this regard. And I don't have anything specific to the whether it's a rolling or a static connect point, but this is how other states are treating federal itemized deductions to give the committee some sense. There were some questions in previous discussions about how other states are addressing these policy questions. So that's the general flow. What's up there right now on page one is just to the point that the committee was just discussing is your initial connection point. So right now we have taxable, federal taxable income, adjusted gross income, of course, is sort of upstream, if you will. So it's a larger tax base. And that's the chart that you see there is just showing adjusted gross income is the blue line, and then the adjusted gross income minus deductions is that orange line. So that reflects the smaller base by having those deductions in place. So initially moving to adjusted gross income, doing nothing else, broadens that base, and then the next step is, well, where do you go from there? To your point, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. So just briefly, as more of a refresher, some of this information the committee's seen before, some of it's going to be new. This slide the committee's seen before, standard versus itemized deductions. The takeaway here is just trying to illustrate the difference. We do have, every taxpayer can take itemized deductions, but the process they go through is you have the standard deduction, and then you can check that against your itemized deductions. And for many taxpayers, the standard deduction is the deduction that they will take. They don't have the sufficient itemized deductions that are greater than the standard deduction, so it's more beneficial for them to take the standard deduction. But in terms of a dollar cents, while the standard deduction represents about 55% of all taxpayers, in terms of the overall deductions, itemized deductions represent about 80%. And that's just reflective of you're not going to itemize unless you have more deductions that are itemizable than you do on the standard. So in terms of overall itemized deductions, what's up in front of you here is just trying to show you which ones are the largest or their relative share of each other, the overall itemized deductions. And this is for tax year 2015. So the data is, it's a few years older, and it doesn't necessarily, or it wouldn't reflect recent changes by the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. So that's just something to put out there. There were changes by the TCJA. One in particular was net limited miscellaneous deductions, which represent about 7% in 2015. Those were eliminated, at least temporarily, by the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. But again, this is a reflection of where things were back in 2015. But you can see it's still the largest one is the home mortgage interest deduction, followed closely by charitable contributions and property taxes, each at about 20% of the overall itemized deductions. In terms of revenue impact, I included estimates that are in the governor's tax expenditure report, just to put in terms of, what's the revenue impact of these deductions? For the home mortgage interest, for biennial figures, these are 1921, you're looking at about $900 million reduction in revenue from the home mortgage interest deduction. Charitable contributions, about $500 million, and then property taxes, about $450 million. And then rounding out the next largest group was the deduction for medical and dental expenses.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Kyle, looking back at medical expenses, is that 2015, and didn't we change that here? We changed it here, but I've forgotten when. Is that reflective of the changes we made at the state level?
Senator Benz, no, the underlying, what you're seeing here is for the federal piece for the medical and dental expenses. So Oregon did have the additional for the elderly. That was changed, I believe, in tax year 2013 to a subtraction. So that's not reflective here now.
Follow up. The charitable contributions with the federal law changing, was that adjusted down by virtue of the higher standard deduction, and thus the thought that there'd be fewer charitable contributions taken?
Yes, Senator Benz. These aren't reflective of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act changes, so that will be something we'll be looking at as the tax returns come in. Of the change, yes, definitely to, if I'm understanding your point there, is with the standard deduction at the federal level going up quite sizably up to $12,000 for a single or $24,000 for a joint filer, it changes the dynamic of people that are, it's reducing the number of taxpayers we expect to itemize at the federal level quite drastically. So in that case, they won't be able to claim the itemized deduction for charitable deductions on their federal return. They still will here in Oregon. There are other implications that could change whether charitable contributions go down, go up, reflective of those tax implications. So at this point, I think it's still a little wait and see to what the data will look like. Of course, we're always a few years back, so it's going to be a few years before we have full year return information to view what's happened, at least in Oregon, on the charitable contributions. But one note as well is reflective of the dynamic of the federal itemized deductions versus here in Oregon, itemized versus the standard deduction. Oregon has put in place a Oregon-only Schedule A form, which will help taxpayers, or should help taxpayers, when they're filing their taxes to make it more obvious. They may take the standard deduction at the federal level, but here in Oregon, that itemized deduction could be a better avenue for them going forward in terms of tax. And that's reflective of, I think, our standard deduction is about $4,400 compared to the federal at $12,000. So we are still significantly lower. So there's going to be quite a bit. We'd still expect about 45% of Oregon taxpayers to be itemizing, where at the federal level, I think the last estimate we'd put out was more like 15%. So there'll be quite a few that will now be standard deduction of the federal itemizers here in Oregon.
Thank you. Chris, did you?
Well, that was the point I wanted to make. The Department of Revenue, this Oregon Schedule A is a brand new form. And so that'll give us some new insight into the information. It'll actually give us some decent information as to a response to how sensitive some of these charitable contributions are. Since they're losing that, there's a chunk of taxpayers who will be losing at the federal level but can still get it at the state level.
And one thing, I think I just misspoke in terms of the comparison. Oregon joint return is about $4,400 for the standard deduction, $24,000 at the federal level. So I think I said $44,000 and $12,000. So it is even more of a stark difference between the two. Okay, so the next group of slides I have here is you're going to see the same charts for each of the major components of the itemized deductions. So you have the home mortgage interest deduction is first, as it is the largest. And the idea being to show the number that are claiming the deduction over the past 10 years. And then, as you can see, we had a peak in about 2007. And this follows, in some cases, of the housing bubble, so to speak. And then that has trailed off in years since, with the most recent year of which is shown here. You actually saw a little bit of an uptick in the number of taxpayers that are claiming this itemized deduction. But the next chart over, I guess the top right corner, the way to read this is it's the same number that are claiming the deduction over the past 10 years, but it's broken down by adjusted gross income category. So this first group of all these bars you see here are the number of taxpayers that claim this itemized deduction that had income in the $0 to $50,000 range. And so each one of these groupings of columns here have the income category down below. And what I think is kind of interesting from looking at this chart is you can see as the number that are claiming the itemized deduction for home mortgage interest over the past 10 years went down, you can quickly get a sense of, well, what type of or what taxpayers based upon income were claiming this back in 2006, 2007 and aren't in 2015. You can see that really is the $0 to $50,000 and the $50 to $100,000 category. Where in the 100 to 250, you actually see an uptick and somewhat flat for the higher of the high or the higher income groups there.
Are you saying that those groups are not taking it? 250 up? Misreading this?
No.
Chair Haas, this is the overall number claiming it. So the reason there's so few there is there's just a lot fewer taxpayers. In terms of the bottom right chart here is the overall share. So why those with income 500,000 or above represent about 3% in 2015, but maybe the 100 to 250 is probably a better example. They represent about 40% of all the claimants for the deduction, whereas in 2006 it's about 26%. And that the blue columns here represent 2006, and you really can see there was a lot more usage of the home mortgage interest deduction during that period in housing where we had, I guess, the subprime crisis and some of those things as well. So it really was, there was more ownership. There was definitely higher home ownership at that time. And a lot of that home ownership where we've seen a decline in home ownership percentage has been at that income levels that are under 100,000. So moving to the next slide here is charitable contributions. And again, it's the same four charts and the same way in which to view it. And in this case, I didn't include the share of the deduction, how that changed over the past 10 years. And that's the bottom right slide. And that's just more reflective of the home mortgage interest deduction. I did show those two different years because there was such a dramatic change over that 10-year period that it seemed worthwhile in showing that. Otherwise, the share of the income groups and what their respective share of the overall deduction represents is fairly constant for the rest of these itemized deductions. But you can see just from the top right chart that in terms of overall numbers, definitely have more claiming this itemized deduction at lower income levels than the higher, and that's again representative of just the number of taxpayers in those income categories. But in terms of overall share, while the number of taxpayers at 500,000 or above is relatively small compared to the overall number that are claiming this, they represent about 31% of the share of the total amount of that deduction that's claimed. So it's giving some sense of definitely those taxpayers are making larger charitable contributions and then claiming those on their return as well. And then just as a note, I included up in the bullets here of the charitable donation, this is information from Giving USA. So this was for 2016, which gives some sense. Question that we get a lot of times when we present this information is, well, what type of contributions do those reflect? And so this is information, third-party information, to give some sense of, well, of the charitable contributions, about 30% are going to religious organizations, 15% to education, 12% to human services, and so forth. But that's just to give some flavor of what these groupings are for the charitable contributions. Okay, so moving down the list, the next one is property taxes. And again, this is part of the state and local taxes deduction. Excuse me. But again, Oregon doesn't allow, one way Oregon differs from the federal Schedule A itemized deductions is Oregon doesn't allow you to deduct your state income taxes when you're filling out your state income tax form. But this is the property taxes here for Oregon represents that SALT cap. This committee has heard quite a bit about of $10,000 that was in the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. So going forward, with the changes in the TCJA, property taxes would be limited to $10,000 or less is what you would claim, even on your Oregon form as well. But again, that $10,000 cap isn't reflected in these numbers as they are pre-Tax Cut and Jobs Act. But just one thing of note, I suppose, in these charts is your claiming of property taxes, of course, is going to correlate in some respect to the home mortgage interest deduction, and that's just reflective of home ownership rates as well. So as home ownership rates go down a bit, that's less home mortgage interest that's deducted. That's also less property taxes that you'll see deducted as well. Okay, so the next one I have here is medical and dental expenses. And the medical and dental expenses, this is a deduction relating to unreimbursed medical expenses that exceed your AGI. So in years past, it's ranged whether it exceeds 7.5 or 10% of your AGI. But so you need to have, because of that exceeding AGI amount, you really do need a large amount relative to your adjusted gross income of these medical and dental expenses. Then it's the amount above that AGI threshold that you actually get to deduct. So this isn't everybody, every taxpayer who has any sort of medical and dental expenses aren't going to be able to claim those. They need to really, they need to exceed that threshold of their adjusted gross income. There was a change in 2013 where that amount that it has to exceed did increase from 7.5% of AGI to 10%, and that's reflective here of where you see that drop off. And then we do have the Tax Cut and Jobs Act put temporarily, at least, that this the threshold at AGI would be 7.5%. It'll go back, or it's scheduled at least to go back under current law to that 10%, beginning, I believe, in tax year 2019. And then the last slide I have related to the itemized deductions in terms of a category here is that net limited miscellaneous. And again, this one in many cases relates to unreimbursed employee expenses. And this is the one the Tax Cut and Jobs Act eliminated in its entirety. So these are figures from, again, from 2015, but at least temporarily in the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, this would be eliminated going forward. And again, through Oregon's connection, that deduction was eliminated effectively here in Oregon as well, because it was eliminated at the federal level. So the next, I guess, segment I have here is looking at other states. So the information here, what the intent was here, is to actually look at, well, how are other states treating itemized deductions? So again, this definitely could relate to where a state connects, whether they're connecting a taxable income or an adjusted gross income. Of course, if a state's connecting adjusted gross income, they then are making a policy decision at that point what itemized or what deductions to bring in. They're not automatically connected downstream, so to speak, from those itemized deductions. And what we've found is generally there's about 17 states that are following federal deductions. There might be a minimal change. Quite a few states do the same as Oregon, where you don't allow state and local taxes to be deducted when you're doing your own state and local taxes. But other than that, it's general conformity is you fill out your Schedule A at the federal level, and then you use that here in your state when you file your state taxes. So that's about 17 of them. 10 states are not allowing itemized deductions. If you're in that category of those 10 states, that doesn't mean you have no deductions or you're not allowing in some respect some of the itemized deduction. I have an example from Massachusetts I'll get to in just a little bit, but it's largely the policy decision is to ignore the deductions at the federal level, and then there might be some picking and choosing of bringing some back or bringing some back at a smaller level or something on those lines, but it's a pretty clean cut, and that's how they get categorized there. Excuse me. The next category down is limiting federal deductions at the state level. That represents about 11, and that's generally where a state is incorporating those federal itemized deductions, but is making other limits to it. So it could be any example, maybe the home mortgage interest deduction, they're eliminating that in some way, or other states have put overall limits on itemized deductions as well. So it means that some policy decision has started with these federal deductions and then in some way added some limiting factor. But again, there can be a different flavor there depending upon the state. The next one down for three states is just following the federal structure, with the exception of the PEAS limitation. The PEAS, again, that's a federal limitation, or was a federal limitation on overall itemized deductions. That went away in the Federal Tax Cut and Jobs Act, so that's not really reflective, I suppose, going forward for these three states. And then, of course, there's about nine states that have no broad-based income tax, so they're not really counted here. A state like Washington, of course, would count. And then the figure two, and this is one that's coming from the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. Excuse me. And it's detailing some of how the states that are listed here, those 11 states that are limiting the federal deductions at the state level, sort of the approach that they've taken on limiting those. And it's a little blurry, but the idea is putting that maybe at a hard cap, or eliminating some of the itemized deductions, but not all of them, So there really is a few different ways that states have taken that approach to limiting those federal deductions. So they're still working within those parameters. They haven't disconnected completely, but they do, they have made some policy decisions to deviate from that. And again, all of these can be done whether your connection is at federal taxable income or adjusted gross income. As you're making the point, Mr. Chair, if you start adjusted gross income and then you're buying these deductions back, that of course is that policy decision at that point of, well, do you want to tweak them? Do you want to expand one, shrink one, bring them all back in exactly the same way, shape, or form? That's certainly doable. And in many cases, the states are still connecting, so to speak, in that they're referencing the federal Internal Revenue Code statutes. So that, of course, would be another, I suppose, decision point of, if there are changes at the federal level, would your state want to then conform to those changes or stick with the way you were running the deductions in previous years? And then I probably won't spend any time here. It was just showing the Massachusetts form. And while they're a state that's considered to be a full disconnect from the itemized deductions, they still have some deductions on their tax form here. And some of them would look familiar, where they're using maybe a state IRC, or they're using a federal reference or a federal deduction, bringing that in and then, or bringing it in and adjusting it in some way, making a policy decision to limit it. But the takeaway there was just, for those states that are in that group that have supposedly no itemized deductions from the federal level, there's still some connection there in some respects. They're not all just a complete clean cut, so to speak. But that's what I have prepared for you there. I know there's a bit there in all those tables, but I'm happy to try to address any questions.
Well, it's interesting to see that lots of states do it lots of different ways. And I don't, I'll just leave it there. All right, we do have some people here to testify on these two bills. So I guess we have a public hearing open on 213 and 214. So feel free to mix and match if you like. And we'll start off with Heather Jackson.
Good afternoon, Senator Mark Haas and Vice Chair Cliff Bentz and the other members of the Senate. I am Heather Jackson, and I am a member of the Taxation Committee with the Oregon Society of CPAs, and a certified public accountant and a partner with a local CPA firm. I appreciate the opportunity to come back and talk to you again this year.
Okay.
I am testifying on behalf of this hearing for the Senate Bill 213, or 213. This is probably the awkwardest one I've ever done. On behalf of approximately 4,000 members of the OSCPA, I am respectfully testifying that we support the bill, with the exceptions of a couple items that I'm going to call out, which are what we call rolling reconnect. I gave you the actual verbiage, but it's reconnect. So basically, there's two sections, 24 and 25, I've listed in bullet point 3, that give the wording that allows for rolling reconnect. That's the wording that is used, that's been in the bill year after year after year, which allows us to stay rolling reconnect. As of January of this year, or December 31st, 18 states still have rolling reconnect. In a year ago, there was about 20 with rolling reconnect. For the static connect, right now there's 19 states with static reconnection, and there used to be 17. So just to kind of give you an idea of where other states are, the rest of the states pick and choose what they conform to. So they're the loose goose. In regards to the supporting it, we're supporting sections 1 through 29 or 28 because we are staying connected. We've updated the date through 12/31/18, which is exactly what we normally come down and testify for and provide information on. We were down here in mid-February. My colleague and I went over all the law changes or the changes that had happened last year with the IRS, and we've already covered all of those, so I'm not covering them today. As a reminder, we're here primarily as technical resource, answering questions and being available. We've always supported Rolling Reconnect. It's what we've done. It's easy to teach and easy to kind of do some tax planning and not having to guess at what's going to happen each and every year. The states with static reconnect generally have been, other than a few states switching, they've been static reconnect for quite some time, and so they're used to whether they have a they have the history with the state of knowing what kind of things they conform to and don't conform to and those kind of things. So planning is still a challenge because you don't know as the year goes on what we are, what they are or are not connecting to. So like us in Oregon, we plan knowing that we're rolling reconnect and we can plan accordingly as we're planning through the year. One of the biggest things is taxpayer compliance, making sure a taxpayer not every taxpayer in the state of Oregon or who files an Oregon tax return is done by a tax preparer. So, you know, a normal Oregonian or person filing an Oregon return, making sure that they're filing correctly, having the correct information on the return isn't a big deal, and we support Rolling Reconnect so that it makes a taxpayer's job a little easier. The only thing that we are right now not connected to is the section 199A, which has already been decided on. Let's see here. And the only thing is, the only other issue is timing of taxes. So one of the things that I know we run into is on the static states or a non-rolling reconnect state is a lot of times it's this time of the year where they're making decisions about the 2018 tax return, and people have already started filing, some have filed a month or two ago, and they may have to amend or refile or have the state come in and adjust their return because they filed before all laws had been finally decided. So just knowing that we usually have people filing as early as January, if at all possible, and if we're having bills come out and changing our laws, then either the state has to adjust their return or they have to file an amended return. So again, just more taxpayer compliance. On behalf of the Oregon Society of CPAs, we are encouraging the support of the Reconnect and the Rolling Reconnect. Any questions?
I appreciate your testimony, Heather, and I guess I would just ask you, do you ever see an appropriate place for the state of Oregon to disagree with federal tax policy as it applies to Oregonians? And if so, what's the best way to handle that?
Senator Haas, I feel like the Rolling Reconnect is almost ideal because then if you do disconnect from one or two items, it's a lot simpler, like the Section 199A, which got disconnected. It's a lot easier to plan and to know what's going on and communicate that than it is to say we don't connect anything and then let's catch up and figure out what we are going to connect to. So I think a one-off is a lot easier to handle than it is to say we're disconnected and then pick up all these things or one item.
I would push back a little bit respectfully. It wasn't all that easy for us. Every time we do this, we have to pass a state law, and in that case, it was a state law that was litigated, and we have seen this come up more often. It wasn't just 199. There were numerous times that we had to do this over the last decade or so.
I'd agree.
So really what we're looking at is a way that doesn't complicate your life needlessly, but at the same time, sometimes the policy decisions made back there don't work for us. And in that case, it was a tax break for a category of taxpayers in which Oregon already had a tax break set up. So it didn't make any sense for us to do both. Right. And yet we went through this painful conversation in order to do that, when an easier way might be to just say, we choose not to do that one. And that's why we're looking at that. And I just really, you know, wish that we could come to some accommodation with the accountants to understand this. And this seems to be happening in an increasing number of instances. So, but we don't want to complicate your life either.
Well, I will say, like, I'll give Section 199A as an example. When that thing came out, it's something that Oregon already had the PTE for. So, knowing that we already had something that does something similar, it kind of has similar rules, knowing that we would probably not follow it, you can kind of make some guesses as to what would happen, because if we have something similar, why would we necessarily stay with it? Does that make sense? So as from a person in my position as doing taxes, knowing what we have already and knowing that we may not choose to do it because we already have something similar in place.
You mentioned tax planning. You want to make things easier. But when that Tax Jobs Act bill passed, it happened quickly and in December of 2017. How in the world could that somehow be a better way to plan than when we, you know, with advance warning say we're going to disconnect or not opt in? I mean, how could that have been good for you? I mean, I understand there's still accountants trying to figure that thing out now.
That was not an ideal situation. the last 2 weeks of the year were not ideal. The biggest thing is as the laws come out during the year, the understanding right now is we're going to connect to it and moving forward and plan that way. If you guys are going to disconnect, I would ask that we kind of get some guidance on how we're going to reconnect. I mean, so that there's some planning to be able to happen, because if we're going through, like, 2018 is not a good example, but if we were going through 2018 and they made a major change, we're going to assume if we have a disconnect or the static connect, we would have no idea whether you would take it or not take it. And we would not know until January, February, March of the following year whether you guys would accept it or keep it static and not accept it. And yet tax returns could be beginning filed and we still don't know the answer. Does that make sense? Did I explain that well?
Yeah, it does, and I guess that's the tension of, you know, if it's just because it's easier is not a reason to justify something that we might deem as poor public policy. I mean, our goal here is, I don't think my responsibility here is to make life easier for tax preparers or accountants. It's to make life better for Oregonians. And these cases come up. They're not common, but they do come up. And so that's really the tension here. We're trying to thread this needle. So right. I appreciate you coming up. And I know that you help us with technical issues, and we keep putting you on the hot seat here. And so
the one thing I will say is with the disconnect, I feel like you may choose to connect with more items. Like if you totally disconnect and then you're saying, oh, these four bills pass, well, we're going to connect to three out of the four. With rolling reconnect, you may choose one or two items that we're going to disconnect on, but usually there's some communication because it's something we already have or it's something similar or whatever the case may be. So we kind of have a warning, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
I understand. Some advanced warning. Senators?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, you know, looking at the federal act, what did we pick up any money as a result of being connected to what happened in D.C.? I noticed Kyle mentioned the SALT situation. We followed him down. Did that mean that Oregon picked up money as a result of that?
Not of that. I mean, not necessarily that specific one. The tax returns I'm doing this year, you're starting at a higher taxable income, because the federal exemptions are gone and less itemized deductions potentially. So Oregon starts at a higher taxable income spot this year. Many more of my taxpayers either owe more or are getting smaller refunds of the returns I've done so far.
Well, Senator Benz. Yeah, so does that mean Oregon's going to see additional income as a result? I mean, from what
based
you're seeing.
What I've seen in my practice, yes.
That's a follow-up. An estimate? 5%, 2%, 500%? I mean, what's your best guess?
I would say probably about 5%, 2 to 5%. And the reason for that is I have a couple of very small taxpayers who aren't paying more, but most of my taxpayers are paying more. But they, if we write a check or not, they're just getting lesser refunds.
Follow up. You're protecting us by saying it's not our fault. Your clients. No, you're not.
It's not your fault. It's the IRS's change.
Thank you.
Thank you.
John Hawkins.
Good afternoon. I'm Chair Hess and Vice Chair Benz and rest of the committee. I'm John Hawkins. I'm a member of the Taxation Committee of the Oregon Society of CPAs. I'm a certified public accountant, and I'm a partner of a local firm here in Salem, Roe, Mueller & Swank. And also mentioned I'm in the middle of my 33rd tax season, so seen a few of these. On behalf of the 4,400 members of the Oregon, members of the Oregon Society of CPAs, I respectfully testify in opposition to Senate Bill 214, which relates to personal income tax, changing the connection point from taxable federal taxable income to federal adjusted gross income, and thereby eliminating itemized deductions and replacing that with a new Oregon standard deduction that's equal to 33% of the federal deduction. So I've got my written comments here. They kind of parallel much of what my colleague Heather has said. So, you know, we generally promote rolling reconnect. I think it provides simplicity for our taxpayers, for our clients. But I think I may deviate just a little bit, just in response to some of Senator Taylor's questions she had at the very beginning. Over the years, I've seen a variety of different methods that Oregon has had. You've had a static connect, and then you've had a rolling reconnect here in more recent years. I can remember back when we had the static reconnect and the legislature met every other year, we were frequently in that odd year left with federal having made some changes, but Oregon hadn't met yet to reconnect, and we were stuck with having to decide, do we file an Oregon return that complies with the federal law but not Oregon, and risks the fact that the Department of Revenue is going to kick back that return as being incorrect, or do we file a return that is complies with federal law, and then we have to come back the next year and amend. And that complexity, I think, has been minimized, lessened, let me say lessened, by the fact that the legislature meets every year. But even right now, as we sit here today, at the federal level, Senator Wyden and Senator Grassley have proposed what we call the Extenders Bill. And this has been a bill that every year for almost as long as I've been in practice, there's been a provision of about 20 or so items that have never been made a permanent part of the tax bill. And they become part of this extender bills that they extend like 1 or 2 years at a time. And for right now, the deduction for mortgage interest, mortgage insurance premiums is not allowed. The deduction for tuition expenses up to $4,000 is not allowed. And there's a few others that if we have a static reconnect, if that bill passes here in the next 3 or 4 months, how do we file our 2018 returns with Oregon? And will you reconnect, you know, because we would have that potentially as a, you know, retroactive, you know, federal law back to January 1, and yet Oregon, as being have a static reconnect, would be, you know, connected to the way the law was, I guess, at the time you meet. So it's that creates a little bit of a complexity, I think, for taxpayers and for advisors in knowing how to prepare returns.
That's a good point, but for practical purposes, we would choose to do that, wouldn't we? I mean,
well, the timing of when for now, the timing that the legislature meets and the timing that people file returns, it leads to this issue. People are filing returns today for their 2018 return. This extender's bill would be to retroactively change the law for 2018. I guess if you do a static reconnect for what the law was as of 12/31 of 18, if this bill is passed later, even though it retroactively goes back and changes the Internal Revenue Code, I guess there's some uncertainty as to how that would apply for the Oregon return. And I haven't, but I remember those years of filing returns and not knowing exactly which way to file, because we thought the legislature would reconnect, but perhaps they wouldn't. And so that uncertainty during the filing season until you guys, until the legislature completes its session and votes on the bills, does create a little bit of a dilemma. And I know that I have a stack of returns in my office that I'm waiting. I'm going to put on extension and wait to see how the dust settles.
Well, I think you're right about going to annual sessions eliminated a lot of the uncertainty and having to wait a year and a half to address changes. In fact, this was one of the compelling reasons for me to go to annual sessions 5 or 6 years ago, and we did that because Congress does make routine changes that we should address. They're not emergencies, but we should address. But when you talk about, the extenders bill, for example, is an unusual situation, and it sort of makes my point about the dysfunction, if you will, in Congress, the difficulties in Congress, that Oregon shouldn't necessarily be part of that on some of these. And that's really the problem as I see it here. And we're just, I guess I'll pose the same questions to you. Is there are times when we increasingly, it seems, don't want to be connected to some of this federal tax policy. And there are a number of states that deal with it a number of different ways. And we're just trying to figure out which is the best way. We don't want to blindly follow everything the federal government does and make that part of state law. And so if we're not going to do it blindly, which is an easy way for you and for us to deal with these policy decisions that say Oregon will write its own tax policy, not something that people outside of our state make.
I believe that a rolling reconnect where you do choose items that you wish to disconnect from provides more certainty, a little more for us. I mean, it just provides us with a little bit more comfort about what the law is likely to be. Frequently we hear about what things that you have some disagreement about, things that you may choose to disconnect from before tax season starts, even before the legislature starts sometimes. But I feel like the rolling reconnect does provide us with some degree of certainty, and particularly for bills that may pass, later after the session has ended. I appreciate the risk that places the state in. I know that I've volunteered for almost 20 years now with Chris on the Revenue Forecast Advisors Committee, and I've seen the state economists come in several times and try to guess what impact this is going to have, and it is I don't want his job. But it is difficult when changes happen.
Senator Benz.
Thank you, Chair. So there's been some discussion over the years about having to keep two sets of books. I think it had to do with depreciation, where our situation was. Are there other situations now where you're having to keep two different sets of records? You have to keep two different sets of records, but have we added to that burden by virtue of, or could we add to that burden by virtue of which selection we make here, and if so, why?
Senator Benz, I think there's a few other places that have created that burden. And I'll comment further on depreciation. That's not just a, you know, if you choose to disconnect for 1 year, then you go back and reconnect. If a client has purchased an asset that has a 15-year life and Oregon has disconnected for that 1 year, for the next 15 years, that client will have a difference in depreciation for that asset. And so there goes, you know, for the next 15 years, different sets of books for Oregon versus federal. It's not just so much different set of books as much it is as I know with the medical subtraction, Oregon used to, you just look at the federal return, and if one person was over a certain age, you got the extra Oregon subtraction. Then it changed to where we had to look at specific taxpayer. And most of my clients don't bring in their information that way. They bring it in, here's our total tax bill for us as a married couple. And now I have to go back to them, and if one of them's over the age, one's under the age, I tell them they have to separate their medical expenses by who went to which doctor. And so some of those things can add complexity. You know, it may seem kind of minor, but it does that add complexity. This tax reform bill, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, did change a number of provisions where corporations, or let me say businesses, can change their method of accounting if their gross receipts were under $25 million. And before, it used to be a $5 million threshold where, for example, if you're over $5 million, many taxpayers had to use the accrual method of accounting versus the cash method. Federal raised that limit from $5 million to $25 million. If Oregon was to disconnect on that provision, then you'd have a client where they might be reporting on a cash basis to federal and you know, accrual basis to Oregon, and that would be extremely complex. So those, you know, there's you haven't done that yet. But those are some of the provisions I think that could create those problems. It's the QBI and the PTE. That's one area where we have differing records that we have to keep. And I understand the policies there.
So the let's assume that there was a change in the federal folks and the bias turned toward raising taxes opposed to reducing them. What would that do to this that we're not connected? In other words, I asked you earlier, your right. Earlier testifier, the message where Oregon taxpayers ended up actually having to pay more by virtue of what the feds did. Is there some value to the default position we take by virtue of trying to anticipate what the feds are going to do? I'm just curious, because then if, I mean, and we're speculating because it's kind of all the tax cut didn't do those people did any good. Right. So who knows what another administration might end up doing.
Right.
But for the purpose of that initial step being linked or not presents a... An initial posture, and I guess that's what we're kind of debating here. I'm busy babbling here, I'm thinking that maybe it doesn't matter because we would come in no matter what happens at that level. If we were connected, we would then back away, opt in, opt out. And so I don't think it's going to matter much because we can't predict what the feds are going to do regardless of who's in charge. So never mind, I didn't have a question.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry about that.
When you said QPI, were you referring to the qualified?
Well, the qualified business income, I'm sorry, the 20% deduction that's that the feds have for pass-throughs entities versus the PTE deduction that Oregon has through pass-through entities. They target almost the same clients. Oregon has some additional requirements that there be Oregon Oregon wages associated with the business. Which imposes a little bit of additional, can be a little bit additional of work to provide those to. I mean, frequently I will do it an entity return and issue K-1s or something to a an owner of a business, and we've got to somehow transmit this additional information just for Oregon. So that was my comment there.
No, I'm good. Thanks.
I didn't finish my way. I do want to say that, if I could, please, that while I came here thinking that this is going to be a total repeal of itemized deductions, I understand that you are considering those. And I just, at the end of my written comments, I mentioned specifically charitable contributions. I just feel I'm concerned about the chilling effect that repealing that would have on charitable donations. And there are many charities out there doing good works that if they didn't do it, the state would have to pick up and do it.
Yeah, nobody has that in mind.
And then two, I have a number of clients that are elderly, and they're pulling lots of money out of their IRAs to pay for assisted living or memory care. And they have, if they lost the medical deduction, that would be a huge tax burden for them if they were pilled. It's sometimes $100,000 a year in cost for some of this care. And if they had $100,000 income from an IRA and no deduction to offset that, that would impose a huge burden on them as well. So I'd just like to you to consider
those. Nobody has that in mind.
Okay.
Nobody's
thank you.
We're looking at this from a revenue neutral standpoint.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Can I read your writing? Claybaugh? Lucinda, I'm sorry.
I apologize for being so sloppy there. My name is Lucinda Heights. Claybaugh, is this on? Here. Am I eating there? My name is Lucinda Heights Claybaugh, and I'm a state licensed tax preparer here in Oregon. I've only been doing taxes for 6 years. I was an educator for 30 years before that. I am here not as a member of OSTC, Oregon Society of Tax Consultants, or of OATC, Oregon Association of Tax Consultants, of which I'm an active member of both, but I'm here as an individual who does taxes. And I probably have a much different clientele than the CPAs do, because most of the people who would go to them would be on the higher end of things. And while I do have a few clients who make money, a majority of the people that I have worked with over my 6 years have been people who are single mothers who have children and are trying to make ends meet and are hoping that there will be enough things that will help them so that they can get some credits for earned income credit and things federally, and also then benefit from the Oregon programs that are similar. I'm concerned that we have a president, and unfortunately, people at the federal level who have benefited on their own from money opportunities or financial opportunities, so that they may be a bit out of touch with what is happening to a majority of the people in this country. And I believe we have a crisis. I see many, many people who are workers, the 99% of America who work for someone else, who are not happy this tax season, because they have lost the 2106 business expenses because of Trump activity with the new tax act. And that hurts people. It makes a lot of people suffer. And a lot of people in this state have been suffering. And as an observation of who I've dealt with this tax season versus the other 5 years that I did previously in working with people and their taxes, and I do speak fluent Spanish, so I work with some very, very poor people who have benefits and get Oregon Health Plan versus people who invent things and are brilliant. So I have a wide range of clients that I have worked with. But I see people, 99% of the people who work for someone, are not going to be able to take their 2106 business expenses this year for the first time. And it's a big shock to people. People are paying $10,000 to $12,000 for taxes when they've always gotten a refund. And that's a shock to the couple that comes in. You've got to be kidding. They can't believe it. What's happening? If you are a single parent and you have children, you might be fortunate if you have a low enough paying job to be able to qualify for earned income credits. But if you were fortunate enough that you actually got a little bit of a raise and you got increased income, then you may not even qualify for some of the things that you'd gotten as credits previously. Things have been cut back to a point where people are getting bills where they always had refunds. And so the reduction of itemized deductions has been such a shock to the majority of people coming in this year to the tax office, and especially in the Black community where I have a lot of clients. It is a major crisis. They can't pay their tax bills. How will it affect people this year? Well, they're going to see a lot of people that are going into debt, and that's all kinds of predatory lending stuff that's going to come up because they're going to need money to pay their tax bill. They're going to have all sorts of people going bankrupt, all sorts of things in the family. Probably will be an increase in domestic abuse. I mean, all who knows what's going to happen, but you're going to see people in stress. Because the majority of people are going to be in stress. They're not going to benefit this tax year. They're going to be hurting this tax year with higher tax bill than they've ever had before. And if you are a small business owner and you don't quite fit the qualifications for the QBIs, you're screwed too. Workers of America, the 99%, are not benefiting from this tax bill that the president put forward. And people who are small business owners but do not have the K-1 thing set up quite the way it should be, or they don't have the partnership quite the way it should be, and they don't have a C-Corp or an S-Corp, they don't have those benefits, will hurt, and they are hurting. So the worst thing that can possibly be done is to take away itemized deductions in the state of Oregon, because that is the one place where people who have huge, huge medical bills have been able to take the special medical subtraction, although that's getting harder and harder to take because they keep upping the age and making things so that you can't even do that. You're getting older and older before you can take it. I know that has ruined things for my husband and I because he's 6 years older than I am. So we really have a mess on our hands. People need to have medical deductions, and they really ought to maintain a 7.5% in the state of Oregon. Doesn't matter what the federal government does. I'd like to believe that in Oregon we care about people, and that we care if people are suffering, and that the common person is not going to be left with so much debt this year that they don't know what to do and how they're going to pay it, and have this incredible amount of bankruptcies that are going to be showing up. Because we don't have a 2106, I think we ought to have something that is similar in the state of Oregon that would replace it, actually, so that people could have itemized deductions still, especially in my case. I'm required as a tax preparer to have at least 30 hours every year. I have to have two of ethics. I have to have updates in federal. I have to have updates in state. I have to have all sorts of additional tax work, and that's just, you know, the things I do for that. For my teaching license, when I taught, I had to have many, many credits on top of that every year, hundreds and hundreds of hours of classes that we have to take for these things for relicensing. Not that we don't want to take those. Oregon tax preparers are the most highly qualified in the entire country. The IRS says we have fewer errors. We are more accurate. We have fewer errors and fewer problems with audits than any other place in the entire United States. And it's because we are required to take all of our classes and stay up with things, be aware of things, try to make these changes and help our clients so that even if the federal government is not doing that, which is good for the majority of American people, that not everybody would be still suffering in Oregon.
Ms. Heitz, we need to wrap it up.
Okay. So I would like to see education expenses maintained in Oregon, other 2106. There are legal expenses that used to be able to take that you can't take now, mileage, basic mileage. There are all sorts of pieces of that where we want people to improve skills, we want people to maintain skills, especially if we're having to convert a lot of people from jobs which were not clean green, Energy New Deal type jobs, but we want to convert them over to other jobs, and they'll need some new training. They'll need to have these things. all of that has been taken away if you're a worker. So we need to be able to maintain things for medical, for charitable deductions. Again, the chilling effect on people not giving when they have so much debt now that they're going to be saddled with.
Well, and we, you know, we had the caveat, it's not in the bill, but we wouldn't be removing any deductions.
Well, I would just encourage people to be strong and independent, regardless of who is president and what is being done by the federal government, that I'd like to think that we could be a little kinder and gentler in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And thank everyone for the discussion today, committee, Chris, Kyle. It's an issue that's probably not going to go away anytime soon, but we'll keep pressing forward. So thank you all. We will adjourn.